It's the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast, where we spend time chatting with expert gardening guests and we ask for their favorite tip. I'm Christy Wilhelmi. Thanks for joining me. My guest today is Joanne Poyoro from Environmental Changemakers, an organization creating positive solutions for today's pressing issues. Through ECM, Joanne has helped create community gardens, a local community oven, Transition Los Angeles, and the Seed Freedom LA Coalition. Joanne is an author, and she has co-founded Cityscape Seeds, and she teaches at Otis College for Art and Design. Changemaker is right, Joanne. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I feel like we could unpack each of those things in your bio in its own podcast, but let's start with Environmental Changemakers. How did that all begin?
Well, Environmental Changemakers began well over a decade ago. We had a group of people who were, at that time, that was before An Inconvenient Truth, that was before Oscars, that was before most people knew about climate change. Mm-hmm. Or if you brought up the idea of climate change, people would debate, did it exist,
right,
rather than what we could do about it. But we had a small group of people here in LA who were saying, okay, we understand it's there. What are we going to do about it? Let's get down to business. And so we started with five people in a room looking at each other going, okay, so what are we going to do? And we gradually looked at various grassroots solutions, things that people could do in their everyday lives that really furthered the conversation. So one of the first things we did, and this was in the days long before anybody thought of plastic bag bans or mm-hmm. anything like that, was we would remind each other to take our reusable bags
grocery
to
bags.
The grocery store
yeah.
and be like, trading tips. Oh, hang them on the door. You know, all that basic stuff.
Yeah.
You know, another big thing we did in those early days was talk about composting. Like, do you set up your composter? Yes. And we would cheer each other. We would applaud each other for these victories.
And what do you remember what year this was?
This would have been in 2005, 2006.
Okay. What happened next?
Well, what happened next? We had been meeting in Holy Nativity Episcopal Church on the premises of the church, and Peter Rood, who is the pastor there still today, mm-hmm. was part of the group, and he was very gung-ho about raising awareness about environmental issues, and so he was thrilled to have this going on right under his nose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he went away with his leadership group at one point, and they came back, and he says, you know that lawn out there? We're going to make it into a garden. I said, that's great. How are you going to do that? And he stared at me. Oh, I get it. I'm leading a garden project.
That's right.
Now. So we started with a small section of lawn and ripped out the lawn. And keep in mind, this was on a very public street corner in the city of Los Angeles. We're talking sidewalks, we're talking houses around. Nobody did stuff like this, but we tore out that lawn and we put in a food garden. So it was front and center to everybody who is
yeah.
driving by.
And it's really beautiful for listeners. I wish I could show, well, maybe we can put a picture of it on the website, because I write a blog post that goes
sure.
along with this. For listeners, it is a corner lot, and the entire front area of the landscaping has been pulled out and replaced with fruit trees and garden beds and brightly colored fences and signposts and things, and it's just adorable, and I think it's a hub now for gathering for people, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it's grown into a whole lot more, but, you know, in those days, we started small. We started with a very small, isolated portion of the lawn, and we took out just that finite portion,
mm-hmm.
and we actually put a fence around it because we thought, oh, gardens have to have fences.
Uh-huh.
But when the opening day came around, we hadn't gotten the gates built. So we had the fences without gates. So it's wide open to the street.
Uh-huh.
And we're now 10 years along, and we've never gotten around to putting in those gates. So this is a garden that is open to the public 24/7, 365. People wander in and out. And we've learned to deal with everything that means. It's
yeah.
been an interesting ride, you know, both in absolute delights, like the man who sat on the bench and said, I taught my son to read on that bench.
Aww.
There's rescue rabbits in the garden, you know, and people come and bring their kids to see the rabbits and visit after school.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people help themselves to our fruit
of
and
course.
Things like that.
Right.
One thing we didn't mention is the initial intent of the garden. Is the intent of the garden was to grow food for LAX Food Pantry. So all of this food that we've been growing for a decade, more than a decade, is going to the local food pantry to help people who are in need. And the demographic over there is a lot of it are families, mm-hmm. a lot of it are people who are working multiple jobs but still cannot make ends meet for their family. So
yeah.
this is food that's going to families and has been doing that for over a decade.
That's fantastic. It really is. It really shows me that community is the anchor of all of this effort that you've been doing. And I feel like that's an important message because here in LA, you know, there's 10 million of us, but it's still really easy to feel alone and isolated and sort of, I don't know, sometimes helpless to do something that actually accomplishes change. So you're empowering people to amplify their impact by getting involved in this community and communities like it. You were instrumental in starting two community gardens, the Holy Nativity one, which is this front lawn garden here, and then Emerson Avenue Community Garden. For our listeners who are interested in starting community gardens, can you share how either or both of them work?
Well, those two gardens run on two different models of community garden. And, you know, here we go into Joanne's esoteric theory of community gardens, that there are different kinds of community gardens. People use the title and they think there's just one.
Mm-hmm.
But there's really several different things that people think of when they think of a community garden.
Mm-hmm.
One is sort of a plot style garden where you go in, you put your name in, you get a plot. That plot is yours. You decide what goes on it and you get the food. You do the work, you get the food.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I call kind of like the traditional plot style community garden. Another kind of community garden is what you see at a lot of churches and nonprofits, is what I call a charity style community garden.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you've got a different set of people are doing the work versus the people who are reaping the benefits.
Yeah.
So that's the community garden at Holy Nativity is on this charity style where we have a team of volunteers that does the planting and the harvesting, and the food goes to people who are in need. The Emerson Garden is more of the traditional plot style where people put their names in, they get a plot, they grow food for themselves, their family. The Emerson Garden is a little bit unique in that the same plot of land is a combination of a school garden and a traditional plot style garden and a community plot pocket park. The city of Los Angeles had designated the property as a community pocket park. So it's got this sort of triple function going on all at the same time. So it's a 1-acre garden.
Mm-hmm.
It's on an LAUSD property.
Campus.
Yeah, campus. And so we had to deal with the whole LAUSD to get that garden planted, which was an interesting adventure because at that time, and this was circa 2008, 2009,
mm-hmm.
LAUSD had not done this before. The learning garden existed, but it had come into being in a different model. That's the garden at Venice High School.
Right.
But this one was at Oroville Wright Middle School in Westchester, and it's an acre. It's still running today. It's running under a nonprofit board at this point.
So it's a 501c3 now.
Exactly.
Okay. And they are, people can get on a waiting list for a plot and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Whereas
exactly.
Here, Holy Nativity is community volunteer based, and then the food goes to the LAX pantry.
That's right.
Great.
That's right.
Fantastic. We haven't talked about your books yet. I want to talk about that. I read that you wrote a book called Legacy, and it was about people getting together to form a community of activists, of environmental activists, and then, boom, you've got a community of environmental activists who are doing things. I think that's really interesting that you wrote a book that became a reality. What else have you written that you've released on the world? Tell us about that.
Well, this is, you know, kind of the imagine it and it can become, you know, and you got to be careful what you ask for because, you know, that I wrote Legacy, and that was actually the first step. You asked how ECM came into being. The first step was I wrote the book, mm-hmm. and people read the book and they said, wait a second, that community group that's inside the book, we want to be a part of that community group. I said, oh, I guess I'm running a community group now, yes. Which was not my original intention when I did that. But since that time, as part of the different things that have happened in the community garden at Holy Nativity over the last decade, for a long while, I taught gardening classes from the garden. Mm-hmm. And as an adjunct to that, I wrote a series of gardening books. So they're available on Amazon. You can look for them, my Change-Making Garden series. But they're really looking at high-yield vegetable gardening with low inputs, gardeners who don't have a lot of time, really looking at sustainable garden practices. So obviously organic, but really deep organic, and looking at regenerative practices that are building the soil life so that nature can be your partner and you can move forward. And so the intention in writing all of those garden books was to help people actually put it into play in their home gardens or in their community garden plots, whatever they had to work with. Mm-hmm. There's actually even one that's food from a flower pot. So even if you don't have a garden, you can do it in pots and on your balcony or your awesome. Doorstep.
Excellent. But you've written something you're working on or have written something else that's coming soon?
Oh, coming soon. Yes, coming soon. We have a new book that's going to be out maybe later this year.
Okay.
And its name is Symbiosis. And it is a novel about a woman who is a landscaper in the future in Los Angeles.
Well, I look forward to that coming out. That will be fun. Let's talk about Cityscape Seeds, because your book is centered in Los Angeles. Cityscape Seeds is also seeds from Los Angeles. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Hyper-localized seeds.
Hyper-localized seeds.
Talk exactly. So we're growing seeds on city properties and have them available at local farmers markets. So this is something we've been doing this for going on 5 years now. And it started with, okay, back to the story of the environmental change makers. We've hosted many different events through all this time. And one of the events we hosted is we brought seed school to Los Angeles.
I took that school. That was amazing.
Well, you were probably in the same class as Matt Van Diepen.
I was.
And on one of the breaks, Matt and I were sitting in the community garden saying, oh my goodness, we were realizing how much was going on with seed, the politics of seed, the loss of diversity in seed, the importance of heirloom seed in this time of climate change, all of these things, critical issues with seed, and people are not thinking about seed. We said, we're going to start a seed company. Like, just out of the blue.
Like, you need one more thing on your plate,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And, like, starting a seed company is something you're going to just do with a drop of a hat either.
Right.
But we did. And we've been selling at local farmers markets. You can find our seed at the homegrown garden stand at the Mar Vista Farmers Market every Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. But also a couple of other farmers markets as well as online on Etsy. But we have hyper-localized. We have been adapting some of these vegetable varieties to Los Angeles growing conditions for some of them 15 years. So there's deep history with some of these varieties. We've got one of the collards is about 15 years history in Los Angeles, and I think the amaranth is close behind that at about 10 years or so.
Very cool. Because locally adapted seed is survival, really. If we end up having to save our own seed and growing it out, you have better luck with seeds that are locally adapted because They've become tolerant to our drought and our, you know, powdery mildew and all the other things that we have going on here.
I'm sure your listeners have had it happen where they bought some seed and it didn't do anything for them. And it looked great in the catalog, but then they get it home, they didn't get any fruit on that tomato or something like that. Yeah. Or, you know, and this is where you have something where the tomato was grown, you know, somewhere where they had plenty of water and not as much summer heat or something like that.
Yeah.
And so when you're instead working with things that are accustomed already to the local growing conditions, then you have a much greater percentage of a chance that you're going to have success.
Right. Yes, I've experienced that. I've gotten seeds from, you know, seed companies that are located in the northern part of the country, and they just don't do as well here. They just don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't buy from those anymore.
Yeah. It's so tempting, though, because they're pretty.
Well, they have pretty pictures.
Yeah,
yes,
true.
But then there's Instagram, and we can all have pretty pictures,
right? That's
right.
You're right. So I remember reading one of your newsletters where you wrote a couple things that I firmly believe but never voiced. One, don't sheet mulch crabgrass. And two, don't plant squash on a hill. Plant in a depression. Can we talk about that?
Sure.
I love this because here in Los Angeles, we don't have a frost. And so crabgrass doesn't die. It just goes dormant. And so I see people, brand new permaculturists, who are like, I'm going to sheet mulch my lawn, which is all crabgrass or Bermuda or devil's grass, whatever you want to call it. The rhizomious running grass that grows at least a foot deep, usually deeper, and sheet mulch doesn't kill it here. How did you...
That's right.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, well, okay, so this is a plant that sprouts based on what's called a stolon. And a stolon is a long, you'll see them, it's a long white stalk, but every few inches it has what's called a node, and that node puts down roots. So when you go through and you break it up, people love to run a rototiller through to get rid of their lawn. And what they're doing is the Bermuda grass goes,
yeah!
And so you've got this, you've done exactly what it wants. It likes a disturbed environment. It doesn't like rich soil. It likes to bake in the heat. Mm-hmm. And it likes to resprout from every one of those nodes. So when you chop it up, you're dividing up all those nodes and creating all these new plants. So one of the first things you want to do when you're starting a brand new garden that has any hint of Bermuda grass on it is get rid of all that stuff and get it off your property.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were creating each of these gardens, you kind of end up sorting your stuff you're pulling from the garden. So sort your weeds, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the stuff that's going to the black trash, and you have the stuff that is going to the compost pile that you, that is desirable. You know, something desirable would be, you know, all those wonderful leaves of a dandelion or a mustard plant or something like that that can go right into your compost.
Yeah.
But the stolons of the Bermuda grass, no way,
mm-hmm.
no way. So get those off your property right away. And then the second thing to do about that Bermuda grass is get your soil really rich as soon as you possibly can, because that stuff does not like rich soil. It likes heavily compacted soil. It likes to bake in the sun. It likes sandy soil.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you keep giving it what it wants, it's going to grow wonderfully for you.
Right. So, and the thing about sheet mulching is people usually put down just a couple of inches, if that, of cardboard when they want to try and kill their lawn, which would work if it were a lawn. But if it's this rhizome type grass, it doesn't kill it. It just makes it angry and sends it off to find the edges of the cardboard.
Angry? It makes it happy.
Well, I call it makes it angry.
Oh,
like,
wow. Thank you for giving me exactly what I want.
That's funny. You're very positive. I come from a negative perspective where I'm like, oh, I'll show you. And it runs to the edges and comes up like, ha ha. And then it, you know, sends up all along those nodes.
Well, and if you look at the tip of it, it's got a very pointy tip. It can perforate that cardboard and come right up through.
Right.
And then you've got really a mess because the plants that you've planted on top of that sheet mulch are now all their roots are intertwined with this garbage plant, and you cannot get them out.
Yeah.
And so it really becomes a thing of, you know, plant it, take care of it once and for all, get it off the property.
Dig it out.
Yeah, I have a free handout on my website that is about Bermuda grass removal. So if anyone wants to download that, you know, hop on change-making.com and you can have that for free.
That's going to help a lot of people because I know I've seen too many new permaculture gardens go down because they didn't get it out like they were supposed to. Now let's talk about squash. The whole idea, you know, everything you read is plant your squash on a hill. And that's for people with really compacted clay soil where they need drainage, right?
Or a lot of those pieces of advice come from the New England area where we started growing, where white folks started growing squash. And so we white folks have passed that knowledge on to other white folks. And so everybody thinks you have to grow on a hill. But that is New England advice. That's New England when we're talking about localized seed. This is also localized advice.
Yes.
And so what do they have in New England that we don't have? They've got cold, okay? And they need to warm their soil as soon as they possibly can in the spring because they need a long growing season for their squash. So they elevate a mound so that the soil will, A, drain all that moisture out that we don't have, and B, warm up quickly from that cold weather that we don't have.
Yeah.
So why are we following this? You know, it's like a double thing that's a double reinforcement on a seasonality that we do not have. So instead, quite a few years back, I discovered a book in the library, a very old book, and it was from a woman who had been studying the Native Americans of the desert Southwest. And I thought, bingo, there's a climate that's like ours in Los Angeles or is like ours is becoming.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I always look at Phoenix and I say, they're only a few years ahead of us. So that's what we're going to look like in a few years is whatever Phoenix is doing now. And these Native Americans of the past, and these were ancient peoples, but this was what she was discovering, was that they planted in a depression. And the idea of the depression was it was a diamond-shaped depression with one of the, you think about the diamond on a pack of cards, and you take one of those points and you bury it deeper into the ground. So it's a slanted diamond with one of the points headed down deeper into Mother Earth. And the whole idea was to take any moisture, any dew, anything that came to the soil and channel it to that bottom of that diamond point. And that was where you planted your squash seeds. And so all around, you had this depression, this diamond-shaped depression. So it had these little, this sort of earthen mound around the diamond. And so I said, wow, we can really learn from that. And at the same time, I was tackling issues of hydrophobia, which I don't know if you've talked about in your podcast.
Please do. I haven't talked about it yet.
Okay.
But it's a big,
hydrophobia.
It's a big deal.
I'm sure you've seen it. If you have sandy soils and in the middle of August, you go out there with your garden hose, you water your garden, and all this top surface looks all nice and wet and dark brown. And as soon as you touch that soil, that quarter inch on the top peels away, and down underneath, it's still pale and sandy and bone dry. And your plants are gasping. And you go, what happened? And so what has happened is hydrophobia is, you know, afraid of water is where you break down the Latin, right? And you have the granules of sand over time. The water is not in the particles of soil. And so the granules of sand are locking together and they're creating an impermeable barrier that the water just rolls out right off the top. And so it's not penetrating down. It's not soaking into where your plant's roots are. So thirsty, it's not feeding your soil organisms, all those things you desperately need to have a really good garden. So what I said, wow, I can combine these ideas. I can take what I'd learned from the Native Americans about the depressions in the deserts of the Southwest, and I can apply that to tackle this hydrophobia problem that we have at, in our soils in the middle of August. Mm-hmm. So I started digging pits. I started gardening in pits.
How deep?
It's varied. It depends on how much I have patience for. One really awesome year, in my home garden, I made a pit that was, maybe it was about 2 to 3 feet in one direction and about 4 to 5 feet in the other direction and maybe a foot deep.
Okay.
And I planted my squash plants, my squash seeds on the walls of this so that the pit was below so that they wouldn't be deluged. The baby plants wouldn't be deluged, but they could reach for their water, right? And so what I would do is I'd flop the garden hose in the middle of the pit and I'd just fill the pit and, you know, that was the end of watering it. Well, when those squashes grew up and I put the trellises in the middle of the pit and the squashes grew up over the top, the pit was still down there. Now, what happens over the life of a squash is you get some erosion. So your walls of your pit start to cave in. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the season, it's not nearly so deep as it was when you started. But, you know, that was how I started it, and it always held water. And it was an excellent way to water through the depths of August because the water was going straight to where the squash roots were.
Right.
I had the most awesome squashes that year. It was really, really cool.
That is awesome. So cool, because I know in my community garden, we have very sandy soil, and you just, you know, the whole idea of planting on a mound is pointless because you water a mound and the water just rolls right off. Like you said, the hydrophobia, it just almost looks like you have oil. The water is swirling around on the surface, beating up in a way, and it just sort of pushes aside if you try and water it, and it exposes more dry patches right underneath.
So here's a way to approach it.
Yeah.
So you get ready to plant your squashes. You look at your garden bed and start digging a hole. And as you dig a hole, you take the material that's coming out of the center of the hole, and you put that around the edges. So you're making a circle or an oval or whatever shape pleases you. Mm-hmm. But you take the contents of the hole, and you make the walls, right?
Right.
Now you take your rich compost and you throw that in the bottom of the pit and you plant your squash seeds on the sides and you throw your garden hose into the pit and fill it up and just see how your squashes turn out.
Yeah, they're a lot happier when they have that basin of water to soak up.
Yeah, now I must say that I was doing vining squashes. I was not doing bush squashes.
Okay.
So, you know, bush squashes would be a little bit, you might have to hold them up so that they don't totally get wet, because you know you don't want to water your squash leaves, right?
Right.
Okay.
Especially coastally, because if we get powdery mildew and it just opens itself up to a lot of other diseases.
Well, mildew to me is like the plant signaling, okay, I'm done. I want to become compost.
Yes.
And it's just nature's way of hastening that process. But to prolong the life of our squash plants, we don't want to water those fuzzy leaves and capture that water right on the surface of the leaf.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. Interesting tidbit, because we're being totally nerdy here. I spoke with Dr. Elaine Ingham about hydrophobia when I took her class years ago. And she said, it's not just the soil particles forming a layer to prevent water from entering. It's actually the microbes forming a seal around the soil particles to keep the water that's left, whatever bare amount of water is left, inside.
Wow.
And I'm like, what? So it's this crazy thing. So, you know, in this way of working with microbes, I keep that in mind. You know, like, soil should always be moist if you can help it. And that's why mulches are a thing too. Do you like to use mulch around your squash as well as the depression? Or how do you do that?
I've been using leaves, so a light kind of mulch. When I was reading Lowenfell and Lewis's book, they, in the back of their book, they start to go into what kind of mulch you should use for what kind of plants.
And they're talking about teeming with microbes, by the way, everybody.
They guided us to use leaves for our annuals, and the chip bark mulch that we typically use really belongs around our trees and in our footpaths.
Right.
So I try to segregate that way when I'm doing the mulch.
Awesome. And I feel like those, what we just talked about, were fantastic tips, but it's tip time. So, do you have a favorite tip that you like to share with your students and with the Garden Nerd audience?
Well, at this point in the calendar year, I'd have to say, do you realize that this is Southern California's most productive time in the garden?
Yes.
So even if you haven't planted your garden yet, now is your time. We're leaving the time of the winter solstice as we record this. We're in mid-January, and we are leaving the time of the winter solstice, that slow time when all the plants kind of slow their growth and hold up for a bit. You're going to see, especially after the rain Southern California just got, all of our plants are going to explode with growth. Mm-hmm. Well, you can get your additional seeds and additional plants into the garden right now. And this is prime time for leafy greens. This is prime time for all of your kales and chards and mustard greens and your mizuna and, you know, garden peas of all varieties, whether that's edible pod peas or peas in a pod, you know, all those wonderful things, your root vegetables, your carrots, your beets, your experiment with something new, salsify, try something dramatically different. You know, there's so many things that love Southern California's cool season. And if you're really interested in what goes in what season, I have a free garden app for that. So if you have an Android phone, look up Veg Garden 365 and you can see what to plant when in your Southern California garden or gardens like Southern California.
You have a chart too, don't you? It's a circular chart. Is that for growing season or is that for something else? It's not a chart. I'm sorry. What's it called? It's a wheel.
I have a vegetable crop rotation wheel as well.
Yes.
That helps you plan your garden rotations. So garden rotations, you do that in your garden for two reasons. One is to reduce soil pathogens that could carry on from one year to the next. And the other reason is to help you boost soil fertility so that you're following a heavy user kind of a plant with something that's going to replenish the soil. And so this is my plug and play development. Is it's a little cardboard wheel and you designate your garden patches and it tells you what to plant and gives you a plant list that you can select from. And actually the garden app works right with that
because
there's indications inside the garden app that tell you what you can do on the garden wheel. So
very cool. And so I know that people can get that wheel on your Etsy page, right?
It's on Etsy. You can also get to it from our change-making.com website.
Okay. And that was my next question, is how do people find you?
Well, come on by my website. I've got lots of fun things. I'm going to be doing a series of posts right now that's carbon reduction tips that you can do in your own life so that you can start right now cutting carbon, because we're all going to have to do it.
Yes.
And so it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And so this is about becoming part of the forerunners, becoming a true change maker, is see how many you can do.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Joanne, for being on the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast.
Well, thanks for having me here. It's been delightful.
All right, Garden Nerds, you'll find links to environmental changemakers and Joanne's personal website on gardennerd.com this week. You'll find links to her Bermuda grass pamphlet and all the other stuff that we talked about today, as well as social media channels for ECM. That's it for this week. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen. Visit us for tons of free gardening information at gardennerd.com. Show your support for this podcast and other free stuff on Garden Nerd by becoming a Patreon subscriber. You'll find us on Instagram and Twitter under GardenNerd1, on Facebook as GardenNerd.com, and of course, our Garden Nerd YouTube channel. Happy gardening!